Thank you very much indeed. Well, it's very nice to be here. I think California is wonderful. Eccentric, but wonderful.
Very happy place.
It is, a nice place to talk about depression. Okay. So let me first of all start off explaining to you why I'm talking about depression at all. I used to belong to what I wittily called the sock school of psychiatry. What is the sock school of psychiatry? You felt a bit low, then you just got on and you pulled up your socks and got on with it. I'm afraid it's not quite like this. I was really quite old. I was 65, and I had a minor heart problem, atrial fibrillation, which was no longer under control. And the doctor started changing the medication. It's an arrhythmia, nothing serious at all. I had a big trip planned to South Africa, and I got very anxious as to if I went into atrial fibrillation, who would get me out and so forth. I went to every doctor in London, and particularly my cardiologist, and they all said, Lewis, there's nothing wrong with you, go. I canceled the trip at once. And went into what I can only describe as a depression. I claimed at that time it was due to one of the drugs, flecainide, which the doctor was giving me for my atrial fibrillation because sotalol was no longer working. But I found it difficult to work. I felt very ill. I found it very difficult to get up in the morning. I got worse and worse, and because I'm at a medical school, I phoned one of my psychiatrist friends, Roland Littlewood, who's very interesting. He's a professor of both psychiatry and anthropology. Roland came to visit me at home and said, look, Lewis, you're severely depressed. And he put me onto a tricyclic compound. And the effect of that was I couldn't urinate at night. And I became more hysterical. I am a hypochondriac, as you can see. And I ended up in into a urologist consulting room, one of my colleagues, to begging him to hospitalize me in case I couldn't urinate at night. He didn't, of course. And things just got gradually worse. And then one night, it's a strange thing, I dreamt of devils. And I woke up the next morning with an overwhelming compulsion to kill myself. I know that sounds weird, but I'm telling you this is what happened. And via various contacts, I got into the local hospital where I was diagnosed as severely depressed. They didn't lock me up. But in a way, getting into hospital was in a way a relief because I knew I was now being looked after. And melancholy, this is a Dura drawing, actually. Oh, why am I doing it like this? It's meant to be the slideshow. You can see how dim I am. View show. Good, better. There you are, there's the Dura drawing. It's a, well, no, I like the lights up. No, for this particular one, it doesn't, just that one if you can turn off. Okay. I like to keep, the one rule I can tell all the young, never turn off the lights if you can. People go to sleep. So depression goes back a long way. I had never been depressed before. It's a very strange business. Some of the descriptions of depression are really quite remarkable. I'm very fond of, first of all, there's a very nice one by the best book on depression is William Styron's Darkness Visible. And he uses the word depression. He says, depression is a word that has slithered through the language like a slug, leaving little trace of its intrinsic malevolence and preventing by its very insipidity a general awareness of the horrible intensity when it is out of control. And it really is the best book. Galen, the Greek doctor, was very interesting. He says, they called it melancholy in those days. Although each melancholic patient acts quite differently than the others, they all seem to be filled with fear or despondency. They find fault with life and hate people, but not all want to die. Others, again, will appear to you quite bizarre because they dread death and desire to die at the same time. It's very characteristic of depression. And also there was an Arab writer in the 10th century who said, he defined it as a certain feeling of dejection and isolation which forms in the soul because of something that the patients think is real, but which is in fact unreal. My new joke about depression is this. It's a bitter joke. I really mean it. If you can describe your severe depression, you have not had one. You enter into a world that I claim, and anybody who's written about it, bears no relationship whatsoever to anything in day-to-day life. Now, because I'm public about my depression, I'll explain to you how I came about that. I speak to lots of depressives, and they all agree with me. I mean, we have jokes about who can manage to describe their worst experience, but it is. And if I can just make a point here, I think it's the next one. I challenge you. You know, literature, the arts are supposed to be so wonderful compared to science. Arts are supposed to reflect the world we live in. Depression, can I tell you, has an incidence of about 10% and a current morbidity of about 4%. 1 in 10 people in all populations go through a depression. Tell me one novel in English which has a good description of depression. I challenge you, n'existe pas, it does not exist. Writers have written about their own depression, Tolstoy, Styron, and so forth, brilliantly. I'm not going to quote Shakespeare. If you look up the speeches from Hamlet, I was going to quote you poems, there's some wonderful poems. But in a novel, not one. If you find one, I'd be very grateful. I was talking to someone who teaches French literature. I can't remember who she was, but she's given me some references which I'm going to look up in French literature when I get back. But it is a very curious thing, and you do enter a world which bears no relationship to anything whatsoever. So I ended up in hospital, quite mad really, wanting to kill myself all the time, not knowing how to do it. I'll come back to that. And I was treated with Ceroxat and eventually cognitive therapy, and I'll come back to that too. But when I came out of hospital after about 3 weeks, I discovered that my wife hadn't told anybody that I'd been depressed. And I said, why not? I've been very ill. She said, I thought it would be very bad for your career if people knew that you were depressed. And I thought, come on. Then a friend of mine phoned me and told me about his hernia operation. I thought, if he can tell me about his hernia, why can't I talk about depression? And then for reasons that no one can remember, even the person who commissioned me, the Guardian newspaper asked me to write an article about depression. That article had more effect than anything else I've written in my life, ever. And then I thought, well, I became interested in depression because I knew nothing about it, and I decided to research it. And what I do is write books, so I wrote a book about it. And, you know,
I...
No, no, sorry, no, 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 absolutely not. Please interrupt. No, no, I was perfectly all right by that.
So was it a good description
of... No, I couldn't describe... I could describe what had happened, mm-hmm. Not a description of... What people liked about it, it was someone... You know, I do media, and I do radio, and I do a little bit of television. Someone more or less in the public eye was standing up and talking about his depression openly. Now please, when I do this to audiences, people come up to me often and say, you're so brave to have done this. Please, I'm a show off, I'm a performer, there is zero bravery. I was already old, it had no effect on my career, they didn't even know I was away from work. I don't think anyhow. Skirts. Okay, we'll talk. Well, tell me afterwards. I would like to see that because I haven't come across it yet. It's quite important.
But the answer to your question is, of course, you can still do theoretical physics if you have a hernia.
Yes. They're quite different, please, I think. Okay, so now the problem with depression, first of all, it's jolly difficult to diagnose. And GPs, general practitioners, are on the whole not terribly good at it, mm-hmm. I regret to say. And the standard one from the standard text, DSM-4, is that if you have four of these and you're feeling low for a period of 2 weeks, then so too much or too little sleep, loss of motor control, fear, guilt, worthy, loveless. If you have four of these over 2 weeks, then you have formally, there's no real proper test for depression. And that makes it difficult for GPs. Also, I have a whole theory about GPs. The last thing a GP wants is another depressive on their books. And people quite often don't like being diagnosed as depressed. I'll come back to that in a moment. Now, what we want to really talk about is what causes depression. It's a little controversial, but the heritability is around 50%. That is, when you get depressed, or for many people, the chances of you getting depressed is about half due to your genes. Alas, we have not a clue what those genes are. It's it's multifactorial, but nevertheless. So that makes things very, very difficult, and I'd be absolutely amazed if there are not amongst you in the audience who will know a particular family in whom depression runs. I would be absolutely amazed if that wasn't the case. But it comes mainly from identical twin studies, and particularly where one of the identical twins, was fostered out or something like that. The evidence is pretty good. For manic depression, the heritability is even higher. It's around about 70 to 80%. And manic depression, which I'm not going to talk about, the depression for manic depressives is the same as this. This is unipolar. For bipolar, where you have the manic phase, you have in addition to the depression, you oscillate between this manic phase and the depressive phase. So it's usually triggered by a loss. So the question is, it's not the cause of depression. It's what triggers depression. So first of all, they're your genes. The best evidence about what triggers a depression, and not causes a depression, what triggers a depression is loss of some sort. Loss of money, loss of prestige, loss of sex, loss of almost anything. And the best work on this is by a man called George Brown in London, who studied mainly women in slightly sub-economic circumstances. And if you're a woman without social support and you haven't got much money and you're stressed in various ways, your likelihood of getting a depression is much higher than anyone else. And life events is what it's caused, can trigger depression. Now, many people have terrible life events and do not get depressed. But many people who do have terrible life events, that's a loss of some sort, do get depressed, and that's partly their background, and I'll come to the background in a moment, and their genes. I think it's important to realize that it's often expressed in physical symptoms. Most doctors will say to you, I don't know where their evidence comes from, I teach medical students, I know how little they know. Most doctors would say that about 30% of the people in their consulting rooms with physical symptoms, it's really from depression. It's somatization. Now, I recently asked the leading psychiatrist in Britain if he understood somatization, and he said to me, look, if you find out something interesting, please let me know. It's really not understand that you express your depression in physical symptoms, tiredness, fatigue. And the classic example is China. In Mao's China, depression would have been a bourgeois disease, out of the question. And when Arthur Kleinman, who was professor of psychiatry and also anthropology at Harvard, went to China in the 80s, he couldn't find anyone who was depressed, but there were many, many people with chronic pain. And when he looked at the people with chronic pain in detail, they all showed signs of depression. And so when one goes cross-culturally, the way depression is expressed is not... In India, it is not, you don't go around saying that I'm depressed. What you say is you have a stomach ache. And one of the nicest examples is in Peru. I went to a psychiatrist. I said, can you tell me, do you get patients who come with the depression? He said, never. He said, what happens? Somebody has stomach problems. They go to the gastroenterologist, can't find anything wrong. They do all sorts of alternative things. Sometimes if they come to me and I treat them for depression, they get better. I think it's important also to realize that I have a colleague at King's College in London who would argue that do you have chronic fatigue syndrome in America? You have ME too? Well, that's related. All these things, he would say, is depression. He would also say post-traumatic stress syndrome does not exist. It's the most desirable diagnosis in psychiatry, because you are not to blame. It's what somebody has done to you. And he would say, in all these cases, it's really somatization, irritable bowel disease. He would say, I'm out of my depth, I don't know whether this is true. But what is very important to realize, and is for me a great puzzle, that yes, life events are important, but purely biological factors can cause depression. Two very important examples. There's an illness called Cushing's syndrome.
Can someone find one of them?
There's an illness called Cushing's syndrome in which the level of cortisol, a stress hormone, is raised. It's usually often due to a tumor in part of the hormone system that it's raised. These people get severely depressed. But,
manic.
Do they? I didn't know that. Do they get manic too? Okay, but the more dramatic example is if you treat someone with hepatitis with alpha interferon, which is a cytokine, you have to give them now an antidepressant at the same time. Alpha interferon, a cytokine or involved with the immune system, causes severe depression. So I think it's very important to realize, like, there are not just two ways of triggering depression. One is the psychological loss, and the other one is the biological. The connection between these, I'm afraid, is a very difficult issue. I think the incidence is about 10%. I think it's very important, and I'm not going to talk much about that, that children do get depressed. In fact, we were at a meeting a couple of years ago at Cold Spring Harbor on childhood depression, and it's a very neglected area, childhood depression. What's interesting is that before puberty, the incidence boys to girls is 1 to 1. After puberty, 2 to 1. Worldwide, the incidence of depression is twice as high in females than males. There is a paper in the literature saying it's not true of Jews, that it's 1 to 1 in Jews, and their argument was because Jewish men don't drink enough. I can only tell you what's in the literature. I can also tell you about religion.
Which way did it go?
Oh no, it makes it worse if you don't drink.
No, I'm just asking. Among that population, there were more men or fewer women?
No, more men. The ratio, no, we can't say that. They just claimed it was what the ratio is 1 to 1, not the incident. Well, I cannot tell you what the absolute numbers are.
It's culturally dependent.
The blunt fact is nobody knows what this 2 to 1 ratio is, but it's universal almost. Now, postnatal depression, even in America, affects about 10% of women. Nobody has a clue why. Now, if you've had a predisposition to depression before, then, you know, of course that's likelihood, but it's a difficult issue, and it's really how much of which is hormonal. There's postnatal blues for a month, but I'm talking about postnatal depression, and that's about 10%. It really is quite severe. That's the thing. Now, what about childhood? Let me make my position very clear. I am very hostile to psychoanalysis. It is witchcraft of the most expensive kind. I ended up with one of my depressions with a psychoanalyst for complicated reasons. Fortunately, I think it's what cured me. He said at $150 a session, $150 for 50 minutes, you'll never get better without my help. Fortunately, I recovered. So what about childhood? To what extent can you blame your parents? There's no question that if you're abused as a child, physically or mentally in any way, your chance of being depressed later on is certainly higher. Loss of a parent, neglect, or if you lose a parent and there isn't sufficient replacement of care, of course you're going to get more depressed. But please don't take psychoanalysis seriously. I'll come back and attack it a bit more in a moment. But so certainly your past, please.
You said that childhood depression is severely is somewhat neglected as a subject.
Yes.
Yet we hear all sorts of probably crazy hysteria in the news that children are taking too many antidepressants allegedly.
I didn't know. That's not in my country. The main hysteria, no, not in Britain. The incidence amongst children is lower. I think it's about a half or a quarter of that amongst adults. The fuss in Britain is about Ritalin. It's not about antidepressants.
Oh, we have that crazy fuss as well here.
I've not seen, in fact, I think there are a very small number of children who are being treated with antidepressants in Britain. But we'll come on to antidepressants in a moment. But certainly, it's a severe problem. And particularly, if you're from a dysfunctional family, your chances of having a childhood depression is certainly greatly increased. So childhood events do affect one. There's no question about it. So those, in a way, are the triggering things. And that's right, that's the twofold increase. And where do we go now? So one of the puzzles then, and that's one of the things that I as a biologist, have asked, to what extent, how can one understand this high incidence? So, has it an evolutionarily adaptive function? There is someone around here in Santa Barbara. I think his name is Hagen or something. Do any of you know? I must find the papers. Anyhow, there are people who claim that a depression is adaptive. I should explain, it's a little bit more complicated. One of my colleagues, in fact, we're collaborating, is a man called Randy Nessie. I cannot recommend too strongly to you a book called Why We Get Sick by Nessie and Williams. And Randy's a psychiatrist from Ann Arbor, and he would argue, let's do Randy first. Randy would argue that low-level sadness or low-level depression is adaptive, we fight about this a bit, is adaptive because it makes people give up unobtainable goals. So you're trying to achieve something, you can't achieve it, and so you reassess your life and think, say, he claims it adaptive. I was on a radio program with a Jungian analyst, and the Jungian analyst said he thought that one of the things about depression from his point of view was it did make people reassess their lives. I said, but hold on a second, about 10% of them kill themselves. Yes, he said, they certainly did reassess their lives. I wish I was witty enough to make that up. That actually happened.
Is there known depression studies in other primates or other animals?
Well, I talked about animals in a moment. Just let's deal with the evolutionary argument. I talk to a lot of depressives. And of course, Randy says, how many have you spoken to? And I said, about 100. He said, well, we did a survey of 1,400 people. I still find it very hard that anyone's had what I would call a clinical depression, where you become disabled. I cannot believe for one single second that it's adaptive. People say, has depression helped you in any way? Have you improved in any way? Yes, I'm good with depressives. And I made quite a lot of money out of my book, as Jim Smith said to me. Only you would make money out of your illness, Lewis. I claim it's not adaptive. So how should we think about it? I think it's simply nonsense to talk about it being adaptive. But there is this guy, something like Hagen, who claims that postnatal depression is adaptive, and it's the way the woman persuades the partner to invest more in the raising of the child. I'm serious. This is published in serious journals. I think I've got them at home. I should really have brought it. Then let's get involved in that. So what's the evolutionary advantage? Is there a level? Why does it happen at all? And what's depression really about? I'll come to the animals. Remind me, Daniel. I think I have a quotation here. Except I've just been through that, and the answer is no. Now, although I'm very critical of psychoanalysis, Freud wrote a very important little essay. And he pointed out that sadness is the emotion most closely associated with depression. And he's absolutely right. Okay. So if we want to understand depression, we need to understand sadness. And once again, it was another analyst called John Bowlby who made an enormous, I think, a significant contribution to the nature of sadness and particularly in relation to attachment. You must all know the experiment in which a mother with a young child, a two-year-old, is in the room, and the mother goes out of the room, and you observe the child gets sad and cries because it's attached and wants to find, it's a loss. And what Bowlby's considerable point is that sadness is about loss because you're attached to something. It's particularly important and instinctive in relation to a mother and a child to a mother, or reproducing partners. When your partner's away, you might feel sad. It's a negative emotion. It's a bit like hunger. It's to make up a loss. And you can have a loss of money, prestige, job, someone showing your theories are wrong, you know. Rarely in my case, I don't know about that. But it is loss. And Bowlby, who was an analyst, made a very, I think, important and significant contribution in this respect. And what I want to argue is that the way to think about depression is to think of it sadness getting out of control. And that's why my book is called Malignant Sadness. And I've got a friend, Marjorie Wallace, who's furious with me because I was talking to her at a party. And I said, Marjorie, I'm writing this book and I'm arguing that depression is a bit like cancer. You know, the depression is to sadness as cancer is to normal cells. Oh, she said, malignant sadness. And I've never credited her with giving me the title, so she's cross with me. Doesn't matter. Another feature, of course, of depression is anxiety. It's never in the textbooks, but they're highly comorbid. And anxiety is about fear of having a loss, as distinct from actual sadness, which is having lost something. And the argument that I want to put to you from an evolutionary point is the following. That just in the way that normal cells can go wrong and give rise to sadness, give rise to cancer, so the emotion of sadness, which is fundamental and totally universal, can give rise to depression. Please.
So what is the evolutionary adaptive role of sadness?
To maintain attachment, particularly of a child to its mother, and the mother to the child in reproducing couples.
Why can't you be happy if she's there instead of being sad?
No, it's sad when she goes away.
I know, but why...
That's what maintains attachment.
Like hunger.
It's like hunger.
No, okay.
There's no question that sadness is adaptive. It's when you have a loss, you want to make up the loss. And the evidence for sadness in relation to mother and child to mother, is absolutely overwhelming. I can discuss it with you. You know, there's a famous Robertson film, The Child Goes to Hospital, and so forth and so on.
That would feel extremely compelled to find your mother without feeling sad about it.
But I'm afraid that's not what happens. You actually cry and you feel sad. You may be, but I'm terribly sorry. That's what happened. That's what evolution chose to do. Remember, there are no general principles other than the ones I told you. So my argument is that what depression is about, it's a mixture of cognitive functions. Oh, sorry, I haven't told you another feature of depression, which is absolutely fundamental. Sadness is basic and universal emotion, is function to promote attachment. Sadness attachment to people, things, and aims, but this is what I want. What about bereavement? It's an interesting point from the evolution. Why are you so sad when someone dies? You do agree that you get sad when someone dies? People in general. It has no adaptive function whatsoever. It's the cost of having been committed. Do you understand? And Darwin made this point too. And there's a standard book on bereavement from which I take this, is not my idea. But I think it's a very important idea. It's the cost of having been committed. That you can find other little things. I don't want to get too involved in that. This is a key feature of depression. Aaron Beck, Philadelphia, psychoanalyst. What struck him when he was listening to his patients talk was not their unconscious thoughts, but their conscious ones. And what he realized, and a major contribution, he's the founder of cognitive therapy, is that depressives were totally negative. They had what he called automatic negative thoughts. Negative thinking, and sorry, have you ever been with a depressed person? Can I just remind you, depressed people are a pain in the ass. They are totally self-involved and totally negative about everything. And Beck's contribution was this concept of totally negative attributions. And it's a major, major contribution. And it really is really very, very important. And these negative attributions are usually false, and I'll come back to them in a moment. So the way I want to think about depression, let me see what my next slide is. Yeah. So I want to argue that it comes from a positive feedback loop of biological sadness and negative cognition. This is the theory. I don't have good evidence for it. Please. Please.
It sounds as if there's a continuum from sadness yes. to depression.
Yes. Nasty problem.
And diagnosis, you said, was very difficult.
Yes.
So where is the line drawn?
You can't. Well, no, sorry, that's a very important point. My friend Jeffrey Gray called it a lumpy continuum. Where you go from being sad, which is a perfectly normal thing, or even feeling very sad, to being depressed is a peculiar thing. Psychiatrists claim this thing, as someone who's been through it, I claim there's a qualitative change. But the best way of thinking about it for me is that you enter a clinical depression, you can't function. So if you measured it in functional terms, if you can still go to work and function, you're on the borderline. But that transition is totally not understood. Sorry, I don't want, please. No, please. Well, you could reason within... Well, so when my psychiatrist said to me, Lewis, you'll get better, I thought she was talking the biggest load of crap I'd ever heard in my life. And nothing she could do could persuade me. Nothing. You can reason... Well, it's more... I don't want to get too involved with myself, but mornings were terrible, nights were terrible. But by evening, I could read a book. But next morning I was back where I started. And that's a standard procedure. Terrible mornings, terrible nights, not too bad in the evening, and then you're back down again. Please.
Could you define negative cognition?
Sorry?
Can you define it more precisely, negative?
Yes, I guess, of course. Of course. Negative cognition, I mean that you see everything in a negative light. Your friends don't like you. Your wife's betraying you, even your dog, you know, won't greet you properly. Everything is perceived negatively. Everything. It's either too hot or too cold, and you feel ill all the time. That's what I mean by negative cognition. And so my argument is it's an interaction between these two. I haven't spoken about the brain. I don't want to get too involved in the brain. Just above your mouth is, I'm very bad at neuroanatomy, there's a region called the amygdala, which is deeply involved in emotions. And people with depression do have an amygdala that on the whole is more lit up. They also tend to have a smaller hippocampus. They also may have lost glial cells from the prefrontal cortex. There's also evidence that the prefrontal cortex is abnormal. Please be, it's not like psychoanalysis, be very careful about imaging studies. I will get shot because Richard Prokoviak is a friend of mine. Do not ever tell him I said this in public. What has imaging helped explain about anything? Niente. You know, it's jam tomorrow, but there ain't no jam today. And one of the leading people in the field of neural networks, whose name I'll keep secret, I said to him, what did he think about neural imaging? He said, Lewis, imagine if you were on a planet and you had a telescope that would show the movement of cars. Yes, you'd see cars moving all over the Earth. What would it actually tell you? A bit like neural imaging. So there are bits of the brain. So the argument I want to say, because of your past experience, because of your genetic predisposition, you have a loss, and you feel worse than the real loss represents. And you confabulate, you rationalize that loss cognitively, and start giving negative attributions to explain your feelings, but that makes you feel worse. So the biology and the cognition interact, and you go down the spiral. It's not a great theory, but it's the best I can do. And I don't know anybody else who's got anything really much better. It has one virtue, that it immediately explains. Well, I think the negative condition, I don't want to get into confabulation at the moment. I'll come into the neural stuff in a moment. I must come back to animals. Do animals get depressed? One of the difficulties in doing drug studies is there's not a good model, animal model for depression. However, if you go to Bethesda, there's a group of rhesus monkeys that's studied by Suomi, and about 10 to 20% of the monkeys when they're born are very sensitive. You know, they're easily frightened and twitchy. If you take one of those monkeys and remove it from its mother and put it under difficult conditions, it takes up that fetal position which you associate with depression, and it looks from all views as if that animal is depressed. There's also evidence that the chemical changes involved are not, which I'm coming on to in a moment, are not unrelated to those in humans. There are studies with mice now about anxiety and things, but there's not really, what we lack is a good model for it. You can also, there's a model by a man called Seligman about learned helplessness in dogs, for example. You keep on giving a shock to a dog and you don't let the dog escape. The dog escape, and eventually it just, you know, sits there in what looks like an almost depressed state. Sorry, please.
So what happens if you give Prozac to the monkey?
I think they do better. I think they do. There is evidence, I simply can't remember, I'd have to look it up. Certainly I think they do better if you raise their serotonin. Please. Sorry, were you there? No, you were just thinking. Okay. Please.
When you start talking about animals, that
yes.
Of course reminds me that there's of course different kinds of humans as well.
No.
So there's been studies of how it correlates with things like physical health, intelligence, and so on. Do really stupid people get depressed?
Absolutely. I've never seen a study which suggests anything. I've never seen anything like that ever. Sorry, it may be true, but I don't believe it. I would be absolutely amazed.
Because there's supposedly there have been studies about different academic departments at universities.
I've not seen it. Well, there is a, sorry, I should just quickly point out that Kay Redfield Jamison wrote a very nice book called Touched by Fire, in which he claims manic depression is associated with creativity. I have never found, I mean, she says it's true of scientists too. I need to be persuaded. I'm not.
What is the distinction between manic depressive and
normal? Oh, because you have a mania. Oh,
I see.
Oh, people who are manic, like Kay. Uh-huh. Oh, she bought 100 penguin books because she was making a zoo. And she also thought she was in outer space, and people who are manic think that they're an animal or will eat raw meat. I've got some description.
What is the evidence of the link to creativity?
Ah, because if you go and look at poets and writers, what percent, quite a lot of them have suffered from manic depression. Yes, that is true, please.
Yeah, so about the animals, I know that there is a so-called mouse model.
Yes, I know.
You throw them in water.
Yeah.
And they can't get out, and basically the...
That's the
mouse that are depressed, they give up.
No. Well, how do you know the mouse is depressed?
Well, because if you give them Prozac, they try much, much longer.
Really? I didn't know. Whose work is that, Morris?
No.
I know the this is where they've got to find the little island where they've got to get...
There is no island. There's no way out.
Well, that's a nice model. I didn't know about that. No, that's nice. That's good. I didn't know about that. I'm suspicious, but it's interesting. I don't know, I just don't know that way. Thank you. If you could give me the reference, I'd be grateful, please.
Science News published an article a few years ago saying that scientists didn't seem to show a correlation with craziness like artists.
That would be my view, too. We're crazy in our own peculiar way, but not like artists.
Not craziness.
No, but whatever it is that drives artists.
No, fair enough, but let's not confuse the two.
I guess.
What do you mean, calling depressives crazy?
Yes, indeed, that is
exactly. The whole stigma issue is, I don't want to get into stigma.
Profound.
Sorry, but somebody was...
Scientists are the ones that made that definition.
Please.
These animal models that you're describing, it sounds like you're mostly describing animals that are put in impossible situations, and at some point they give up. Is that really a sign of depression, a loss of...
I don't know. I just don't... I find,
it doesn't seem to be like a rational response. Stop wasting energy and wait for certain...
Well, that's just like the adaptive function of depression. There are some sort of, crazy psychiatrists who claim that actually depression is adaptive, because in the same way that it comes from our ape-like ancestors, that when you're in a hierarchical situation, if you're being dominated, you must adopt a depressed posture. It's just such nonsense, I can't stand it. And I refuse to talk about it. No signal. Let's talk about, so the virtue of the model that I've offered you, and I'd love to hear about that, the water rats, or water mice, please. The particular model that I've been offering you involves cognition and biology. That's the interaction between the two. And the only virtue of it is that the two ways...
How do you distinguish between emotion and cognition?
Boy. Well, we just organized a meeting on emotion at Cold Spring Harbor. It was earlier this, just about 4 months ago. Emotion's a tricky issue. But I think thinking, you know, if I'm thinking about how I'm going to continue with this lecture, it may have an emotional content, but the actual thinking about it, I think, is different from the emotion which is guiding what I'm actually doing. So my current position on emotion is there is no movement you make that isn't initially specified by an emotion. So emotion is really determines what actions you take. Now, cognition is really about thinking, but what you think about is determined by your emotions. They are really different. But if I knew the relationship between emotion and cognition, I'd be in business. Very difficult.
But cognition we think of as a organized activity.
It is not. Well, talk, sure, talking.
Whereas emotion is
not organized.
Situated in the brain.
Absolutely. No question. It determines what you do. Hunger is an emotion. I totally disagree with Damasio. I'm in fundamental disagreement. I've changed my position completely. I claim that even if I scratch my nose, it's emotionally driven. Don't let's get it's a whole other topic. But just let me say that the way of dealing with depression is by two ways, antidepressants and psychotherapy, okay, and particularly cognitive therapy. The latest, most antidepressants... ECT, sorry, please, very important. Let me just quickly deal with ECT. Electroconvulsive therapy, because one threw over the cuckoo's nest, has got a very bad reputation, and it's wicked, because many people's lives are saved by ECT. All the evidence is that given properly, yes, there may be a little memory loss, but for very severe depression, I begged for ECT when I was really bad. It can save lives, and properly given, it can be a lifesaver. The problems that I hear about it from Sweden is that while the effect is very good, it doesn't last for very long, you know, than a couple of months. You see, just can I remind you, it's a tricky issue. 80% of all depressions will resolve, if say you do nothing, 80% of them will disappear within a year if you haven't killed yourself. Just remember, suicide is very high amongst depressives. About 1 in 10 try and actually succeed. Sorry, it's a high percentage. Suicidal thoughts are very common amongst depressives. The reason I didn't kill myself, I didn't know how to. I know that sounds weird. I was too frightened to jump. So he was asking, could I reason? Yes. I was still frightened. I couldn't jump. And I didn't know what drug to take, easily accessible, that I would sure would not make me even worse. And what stopped me killing myself was my wife got very angry. And she made a bargain with me that if I wasn't better in a year, she'd help me die. And that stopped me. The terrible irony was she was the one that died. That's another story. Poof. The modern antidepressants, the most antidepressants, affect the system here, the neurotransmitter, particularly in relation to adrenaline, noradrenaline, but this one I'm relating to serotonin. And what's interesting here is this reuptake transporter. So as serotonin is released at the nerve ending, binds to the postsynaptic cell, stimulates the cell, and then the serotonin is taken up again by this transporter. And it is thought that Prozac, Seroxat, I take my Paxil every morning, I just have to tell you, is blocking this process here. But please, it's more complicated than that, because when you take Prozac, this is blocked almost at once, you know, within half an hour or an hour. For an antidepressant to work, 2 to 3 weeks, sometimes 12 weeks. Now, just let's talk about antidepressants. There is no one antidepressant that's any better than any other antidepressant. As someone thinks, it's like from Alice in Wonderland, everybody wins. It depends on the antidepressant that suits you. Different people respond to different antidepressants. The trick is to find the right one. The other point is that in all the studies practically, you give 60% will improve with any antidepressant. 30 to 40 will not improve. About two-thirds will get better. Of those two-thirds, one-third is placebo, or they would have got better on their own. So for all antidepressants, to improve one person, you have to treat three. And that's true of all antidepressants. Please think. Side effects, yes, it does nothing for your sex life. But would you rather be depressed or have no sex? Sorry, there's Viagra around, and that helps a lot. No, depression is pretty frightening. No one antidepressant, that's them there. ECT for very severe cases. Psychotherapy, please.
How about the new non-receiving?
The non-what? I simply haven't read the literature. Are they much better? I'd be very surprised. Sorry, really? I haven't. Well, that would be lovely if it were true. But on the whole, the evidence seems to be, I haven't looked at that recently, on the whole it seems, you know, it helps about one-third of the people. Psychotherapy, about the same. The ideal thing is to have both. And what's psychotherapy about? The one that I'm an evangelist for is cognitive therapy. What's cognitive therapy? Is the therapist gets you to change the way, oh God, what have I lost here? I don't know if I've got anything on here. No, we don't want to get involved in all that. Yeah, can cut the positive feedback loop. Okay, somatization remains a mystery. We can turn this thing off. What happens in cognitive therapy is what the therapist tries to do is to show you how your attributions are negative. And my favorite example is the man in therapy says, nobody loves me. And the therapist says, what about your dog? And the chap says, yes, my dog does love me. Now, you may think that's trivial, but to show just one crack in this negative framework is already a step forward. You also keep a diary, because no depressive ever remembers a good day. But you look in the diary and the therapist can say you haven't been well all week, but look, on Thursday, you really had a good... Anything to crack this negative thing. Where it helped me enormously, I was getting slightly better. And I was terrified about going back to work because I didn't think I'd be able to cope. And what she did is we had a scenario. She said, let's imagine you go back. Let's play it. Imagine you go back. And you're not deeply involved, but you'll sit on the outside of the committee. And if you have to walk out, how terrible will that be? And it didn't seem that terrible, and I managed to go. And the fact if you can do one positive thing, that's already reinforcing because you recognize that and you record it. I know it sounds weird and it sounds so simple and commonsensical, but it makes the most enormous difference. I think also, I've had several depressions. After the big one, I've had two since. And there was a stage where I couldn't work in the morning, and my psychiatrist said, look, don't work in the morning. Go to work in the afternoon. I know it sounds ridiculous, but getting that permission is psychologically really, really important. And what I want to emphasize, though, if you know depressives, the people who have a nightmare with depression are the people who live with them. As I've already said, depressives are totally self-involved and totally negative. They are hell to be with, and you cannot help them. You can be supportive as a carer, but you cannot cure them. People think you can jolly someone out of their depression. Please, please, you cannot. What has to happen is the person has to be persuaded that they're depressed, and they have to do something about it. If it's yoga, meditation, religion, jogging, I'm a jogger, I'm an exercise person, they've got to find that which works for them. Usually professional help, it may be groups of other, you know, there are lots of depression alliance and things. But I think it's very, very important for carers to know that they cannot do it. Please.
Is there a difference in recovery rates or recovery probabilities between single people and people with extended family?
I don't know the data, but Julian Leff has written an interesting book. And one of the depressing parts of this book is that he was treating patients and then asked the partner to come in, and they were shocked how many of them were depressed too. Now, and Julian's preference is social psychiatry, the interest of psychiatry. I don't want to call it infective, but living with a depressed person can be very, very, very stressful. Sorry, Deborah, you were going to ask something.
I was wondering if it's obvious, if suppose you're getting better, you're having your treatment, yeah, and you have your drug.
Yeah.
Is it obvious when to stop taking the drug?
Oh, please. Do not stop taking the drug. Sorry. I am going to be taking my low dose of Paxil or Ceroxat in my case until I die. People say, does it help? I don't know, and I don't intend to try and find out. Yes, maybe it has side effects. Certainly sexually it does you no good whatsoever. But I keep saying there is Viagra. Makes me slightly manic, very faintly, a little thing. But I don't know what I'd do if I had another depression. You know, I've had three.
Somebody has found the right drug for them or something with worse side.
Well, I think, well, you've got to make it, you know, it's a cost-benefit analysis. Or you've got to try another antidepressant. There are people who can't find the right antidepressant. I think everybody's, you know, the famous book is called The Anatomy of Melancholy by Burton. And his last sentence is, be not idle. The essence for a depressive is to try and find out what works for them. Whether it's meditation, yoga, coloring pictures, going to the movies, exercise or whatever it is, or the antidepressant that suits you. But certainly all the evidence at the moment is you should not give up your antidepressant too soon. I think I've almost, I don't think I've got anything else. I've got anything else to say. Thank you very much.
Questions? Comments?
Yeah.
One over there.
You said that you don't believe chronic fatigue is, well, you believe that chronic fatigue syndrome is in fact depression.
I think that's what some people would argue. I'm not in a position to say this, but the evidence seems quite good, yes.
Now, I understand that there is, however, it is commonly said to be associated with
the
virus.
I know. I think the evidence is very poor as far as I can make. It's not. Sorry, you do remember, I'm not a doctor or a psychiatrist, you know, I'm a developmental biologist. The evidence that I've looked at from what people tell me looks more like depression. The evidence of the virus is very, very poor.
I know a person who claims to have both and is very resentful of the notion that
I know.
There's nothing
more resentful. Listen, I believed, I was this evangelist for depression. But I claimed it was nothing psychological at all. It was that drug I took for my heart. Rubbish. We'd much rather have a biological explanation, a virus, than it's something inside us. And that's something one had to...
Sorry. Again, you just said you think it's something inside, something psychological.
Yes, I'm afraid so.
And so I'm a bit surprised that you suggested there weren't differences across cultures. Because different cultures deal with feelings and emotions very differently.
Well, the curious thing, you know, it's difficult to diagnose, but from what I've read, and when I went, I've been to China, I've been to India, I've been to Peru, I've been to Japan, and in all these countries, there's no question there's a lot of depression. The World Health Organization claims that depression in the next 10 years will be the most disabling illness worldwide. So it's not just a little Western something. Now, how it's expressed is precisely in very different ways. But and because there's no biological test for it, there are problems here. But that's the WHO, and that's certainly what Kleinman would say You know, and certainly when I went to those countries, there was no question there was lots of depression about it. How it was treated was very different.
Very horrible.
Yeah, just something in general, are people who become depressed and then recover more likely to become depressed than people?
Yes, absolutely. I have about a 90% probability of having another depression. I've had two. I've had three. And the evidence is I've got about a 90% chance of having another. That's why I'm sticking to my antidepressant. I take quite a low dose.
David Cross?
Have you thought of whether mania is the opposite cycle?
Well, mania, I'm not good on mania.
Happiness drives you to explain why you're happy, which makes you happier.
I have a friend who's writing a book on happiness at the moment, actually. And I've just been to a 2-day meeting on happiness.
How happy?
Well, I was the negative influence there. I was the unhappy one there. Because I felt it was very, very difficult to measure happiness. He's a professor of economics at LSE, Richard Layard. And economists want to understand what makes people, what makes people. I'm not good on mania. And whether it's just the opposite or what's involved there is very hard to know. If you want a wonderful description, Kay Redfield Jamison's, I've forgotten what the title of her book is, but it's wonderful. A Disturbed Mind, I think it was, I can't remember.
Jamison?
With Kay Redfield Jamison.
An Unquiet Mind.
An Unquiet Mind, thank you very much. Wonderful book.
Question. Yeah.
Please.
Yeah, I was wondering if you had any thoughts on, forgive me if I pronounce
wrong,
dysthymia, which is...
Well, but what does it mean? You mean it's low-level depression, feeling low all the time?
And also, like, not the 2-week period, like, you left, right?
I didn't know that.
I think it would be if it's, you get the same thing, but you know, for a 2-week period, for longer than 2 years, you know, it comes to
just don't know. Sorry, I have nothing useful to say on that.
Professor Scalapino?
Please.
What about lithium?
Oh, lithium, I'm sorry, that's for manic depression. And sorry, I all hope you know about John Cade. Do you not know about John Cade? You should be ashamed of yourselves. No, he discovered the effect of lithium on manic depression. Can I tell you how he did it? This Australian, I was married to one, so I'm quite positive about Australia, thought that what depression, what the mania was, there was too much some substance. So what he did, he took the urine of manic depressants and injected them into guinea pigs. And he found the guinea pigs, some of them got more manic than others. Then he tried to isolate the substance. And at one stage, he used lithium to dissolve the compounds. But he did a control. And he injected lithium directly, pure, into the guinea pigs. And they got calmer. And that's how lithium was discovered. And it saved the lives of tens of thousands. John Cade. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful discovery. And if you ask how lithium acts to do this, very poorly understood. Sorry about that.
Questions?
No, we can, please.
Do you think people who attempt suicide are always depressed?
Yes. I think there are, the evidence is that most people, if you look back on people who've committed suicide, you can find good evidence for depression. And can I just make a point about suicide? You've got to be jolly careful. Many suicides look like accidents. So let me tell you a story of a woman I know who wanted to commit suicide. She was depressed, but she didn't want to harm her young children. So she decided to take motorbike lessons, knowing that if she were killed on the motorbike, there would be no shame. Fortunately, you know, she got better. But you can see, and I know friends of mine who say, no, I'm not suicidal, but as I'm driving back to Cambridge, and at 80 miles an hour, and there's a curve in the road, there's a temptation to go straight. So there are more, what very often looks like accidents, ain't. And there is the impulse with suicide. And sorry, there is some evidence that if you are very depressed, and you take an antidepressant, and you start getting better, your chances of suicide go up. Because when you're really down, you haven't got the energy, the psychic energy to do it. But as you're getting better, you do. So that is a danger which has to be watched.
You've notably not remarked on the connections. I mean, you've remarked on the state of the world and the likely rise in depression. between depression and rage, which many people do make, and I'm curious about your.
I'm not good on rage, but I know. I know when I was in Harvard, there was someone, and I've got in my book that quite a lot of depressives do get very angry. I think you've got to be careful about depression being on the increase. I'm very suspicious about this data. It's about diagnosis, more openness, and so forth. I don't know. Certainly, as I say, WHO sees it as the major health problem in the world. I think it's enough. Come on, we can have coffee.
Well, more questions, or should we continue over coffee?
Can you continue over coffee?
Last time we speak again.